And he said the final outcome of the practice was what they call the Akinchayatana, is the sphere or the realm of nothingness. Okay, so the realm of what they call nothingness, Akinchayatana, is actually a very exalted, very refined meditation attainment. Okay, it's one of the very highest levels of samadhi. And so you know, he's teaching a very, very refined teaching. This is not you know, kindergarten stuff. This is you know, anyone who can get to that kind of level of samadhi is doing pretty well. And then he reflected, the Bodhisattva reflected to himself, as says in the text, not only this my teacher, Alara Kalama, has faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, right, concentration, and wisdom, okay, had all of those five things, but I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. So if you're familiar with the Buddha's teachings, then you should recognize that this group of five factors is what we call the five spiritual faculties. Yeah, saddha, virya, sati, samadhi, panya. Five spiritual faculties. So he's saying that his teacher, Lara Kalama, possessed these good qualities, and so did he. So he went forth, he practiced, and he realized, based on these good qualities, the akinchayatana, the sphere of nothingness. So what's the akinchayatana? Well, it's one of these things which, you know, to try to describe it or conceptualize it is pretty difficult. But the only thing it actually says in the text, it says, you know, that one enters and abides in that, and you're aware of nati kinchi, which means nothing at all. Okay, nothing whatsoever. Nati kinchi. Yeah? Nati kinchi. There's nothing to it. Yeah. And the suttas, of course, are fairly brief in their description of these states of consciousness. But according to the description in the Visuddhimagga, what it says, to put it very briefly, is that normally when we meditate, that you meditate based on a nimitta. You have a sign of meditation. You see a light or something like that. So you see this light. Let's just say it's a light for now. So a disc of light. To make it easy to understand, you see a disc of light. Then you reach the fourth jhana, and then you expand that light to infinity. Okay? Yeah? So you see this light, the infinity of light everywhere. Yeah? And then you take it away. So you're just seeing an infinity of space where that light used to be. Right? So this is the infinity of space, the first of the formless attainments. And then you then reflect, oh, well, what is aware of this infinity of space is an infinite consciousness. Yeah? To be aware of the infinite space is this infinite consciousness. So this is the second one, is the base of infinite consciousness. And then you reflect, well, this infinite consciousness, you know, this whole infinite consciousness business is just a real hassle, right? Because there's still this consciousness which is suffering. So instead of being aware of infinite consciousness, I'll just be aware of nothing at all. So you drop the infinite consciousness and you wear nati kinchi, so this is the base of nothingness. But then you're still aware of nothing at all. So even that's too coarse, right? That's just too much. It's too intense. So you say, okay, I'll just let go of being aware, and you go to what they call neither perception nor non-perception, where you're not quite aware and you're not quite not aware. Right? So this is one of the highest levels of samadhi. So this is a description that they give for these levels of attainment. So whatever that these guys were doing, you know, they were pretty out there. You know, these are some serious meditating sages in the classical Indian tradition. We don't know very much about who they were, and the texts are not very clear in terms of what particular school did they belong to, what was their philosophy, and so on. But it seems likely, the most likely thing is that they were Brahmanical sages who were practicing in the tradition, teaching tradition that we find in the Upanishads. So if you look at the Hindu Upanishads, which were written, the oldest ones written a couple of hundred years before the Buddha, they talk about states of meditation and philosophies and so on, which sound similar to what we're hearing from this Alarika Lama and Uddaka Ramaputta. So it seems likely that that's what they were practicing. And it's very important to understand that, because in that, remember that description, the Buddha said the first thing he learnt was the teaching, right? He learnt the text recital. What are they actually teaching? He learnt that first. Then he went and practiced the meditation. Then he went to the teacher and said, is this what you're teaching? Is this it? And the teacher said, yeah, that's it. You've got it, right? And then first teacher, Alarika Lama, said, okay, you can, I'll put you beside me, you know, we'll teach together, yeah? Because you've attained to the same Dhamma that I've attained to, yeah? Which is very humble, isn't it? Yeah? It's actually a sign of a very sincere teacher. So they're teaching a very high level of meditation, and they're clearly very, very sincere teachers, right? That's not what, you know, if you're a cult leader or something like that, that's not what you do. As soon as you see someone who's got good, you know, meditation talent, you immediately get rid of them, right? Yeah. Because they're going to be a rival, yeah? So here you want someone who's going to be just as good as you are, and you say, please, you come, and we'll lead this together. So the Buddha said, well, if that's it, if that's all, I'm out of here. All right? That's it. That's all you've got is just the aware, infinite consciousness aware of this nothing whatsoever and this absorption in that. And then you just get reborn in this realm for a mere trifling 60,000 eons. Okay? That's it. And that's the best you can offer. Right? Not good enough, he said. All right? So he's out. He had standards, all right? Most of us feel pretty good if we can find like 2 minutes of feeling relatively peaceful in meditation. And we think, oh, great, that's really good. That's really worthwhile. The Buddha, nah, 60,000 eons of blissful absorption. No, that's not good enough for me. So when the Buddha rejected that, then it's important to realize why he rejected it. And it's very explicit. The text is very explicit there. It says, Yava deva akinchanya yatanam. Upapannaya sangvatanti, sangvatati. This only leads to rebirth in the realm of nothing, of nothingness. Okay, so because you practice that meditation at the very profound level, then you get reborn in that realm, and then you last in that realm for a period of time, 60,000 eons, and that's it. And the Buddha said, I'm going to reject that Dhamma. It's not good enough for me. So then he went on. He went to the next teacher, Uddaka Ramaputta, who taught an even higher level of samadhi, neva sanya na sanya, neither perception nor non-perception, and he also rejected that. There's an interesting little textual quirk there, because when Alarika Lama spoke to the Bodhisattva, he said, you know, let's teach this together, right? We'll be equals. But when Uddaka Ramaputta does it, he says that same Dhamma which you've attained, right, if you've attained now, Rama had attained to that as well. So remember, this person's name is Uddaka Ramaputta, which means Uddaka, the son of Rama. And so he said Rama had attained to this as well. So it seems that actually Uddaka Ramaputta himself didn't actually realize that stage, that his teacher, so Rama, perhaps his literal father or perhaps a spiritual teacher, had attained to this and had taught it, and he was passing down. And so because of that, he actually asked Siddhartha to become the leader, to actually be in front of him and to teach the community. But again, he said, no, that's not good enough, and he went forth and to practice some more. So this is already, you know, we've already learned some very, very important things about the Buddha, about his quest, about the spiritual practice. Yeah, first thing is, even really good teachers, yeah, they were really good teachers, they were the best available, yeah, they still maybe they don't have the answers. Yeah? This is very, very important to remember. It wasn't that they were bad teachers. It wasn't that they weren't corrupt. They weren't evil. They weren't, you know, they weren't doing anything bad. They were teaching very beautiful, very refined states of mind. They probably had there's a very beautiful philosophy in the Upanishads, the Tathāgatāsi, thou art that. This little self that you have here is actually the same as the cosmic Brahman, the essence of the soul of the universe. Yeah, it's a very, very beautiful teaching. Yeah, it's one of the most beautiful religious teachings that you can possibly have. And yet, even that, the Buddha was not satisfied with. Yeah. So this is a very important lesson for us in our practice. Is to, the Buddha remembered, and he reflected Why is it that I went forth to practice in the first place? And the reason I went forth to practice in the first place was to seek an ending of birth, aging and death, to overcome birth, aging and death. And we realize this only leads to another kind of rebirth. Yeah? So just think of that. How easy it would be to get caught up in that. Imagine that. Imagine just being able to sit in that incredibly peaceful and profound meditation. And to be able to say, well, I can just stay here in the forest peacefully, there's a nice community, I have a good teacher, I can just sit here in this beautiful, blissful meditation, I'm not harming anybody, there's nothing bad about it, I'll be reborn after my death and I'll live for such a long time in this very beautiful divine realm. Yeah? And to say, no, that's not enough, and to leave it behind. Yeah? Yeah? It's a big deal, yeah? There's very, very few people actually able to do that. So this is one of the reasons why the Buddha became such a profound teacher, yeah? That he was able to go beyond even the very, very, the best of what was available at the time. So always to keep that spirit of that kind of almost restless inquiry which he had. No, it's not good enough. What can I do? Where can I go? What actually is, how can I overcome that suffering? So then he left those teachers and he went forth, and the next thing he did was to practice the self-mortification. And of course this is again something that's quite extraordinary, because you know that he's gone from such an experience of comfort and luxury in his palace. Yeah? He's left that and he's practicing, first of all he's practicing these very blissful samadhi experiences, and it's, you know, very, very lovely and peaceful and so on. And then he goes and does all these bizarre kinds of self-torture. And there's long lists of it in the Pali Canon. It's actually one of the most vivid and detailed sections in the whole of the Pali Canon. He talks about all the different kinds of practices that he did, which I won't go into all the details, but like starving himself to death and breathing, like forcing himself to do the non-breath meditation. You just basically sit there and don't breathe until you collapse and fall over unconscious, you know. And so many different kinds of things that he did. And on and on and on. You know, he would eat cow dung. Yeah? That was he just lived on cow dung for being away. He would never see anybody. He would run away as soon as he saw any person. He'd run to the hills, yeah? Like a wild deer, he said. And until, you know, he looked like he was dead. He said it's a very vivid description. He says his eyes were sunk, like the brightness, the gleam of his eyes was sunk like the water sunk down a dried up well. Yeah, it's like the gleam of that. It's a very, very vivid image, isn't it? And the kind of the back, the bones on his back sticking out. Yeah, and so everyone said, people thought he was dead. You know, his skin had dried up and gone black, and his hair was just, he'd just rub his skin and his hair would fall out. You know? And he did all of these things. So, you know, in India today, they still do a lot of these things. If you've been in India, I'm sure you've seen a few out there kind of yogis, yeah? And they're very inventive in how they... up in the air, yeah. For years at a time sometimes, yeah? And if you can see, you put your arm up, but that's like the wimp's practice. Because the real hard one is to put both arms up. Yeah, you think about it, right? Yeah. That's not easy. Yeah, and people do all kinds of things. You know, like one I heard about who did a pilgrimage rolling across India. And if you know what's lying on the ground in India every few yards, then to roll across the ground is not something you want to think about too clearly. Yeah. Anyway, so, but they're still doing it, you know, and at the end of it, the Buddha said, well, I haven't got anywhere. For years he did it, years. And at the end of it, he said, I haven't got anywhere. Now, this should be very disturbing for everybody, okay? I think we get so used to this being a part of a Buddha's story that we forget how deeply disturbing it is. How dumb was he? Right? Think about it. We can all sit here and realize, we can laugh and think, yeah, that's you know, oh, it's ridiculous, you know, going and doing all these silly things. How dumb was the Bodhisattva that he would do those kinds of practices? Why would he do it? If it's so obvious that those practices are silly and they're not getting anywhere, which it seems to me pretty obvious, but lots of people have done them, yeah? Lots of rishi, lots of, not just in Buddhism, but in a lot of the Christian monastics, they would do very, very similar practices. And what was it, the one, I can't remember his name, my favourite one was the Christian, he lived off a pole. I remember Simon, I think Simon Stylites or something. And he used to live off a pole for long periods of time, and he had these kind of wounds that would grow, and the maggots would grow in his wounds. And when the maggots would fall off the wounds, he'd pick them up again very carefully and put them back out of compassion. So lots of people do this, yeah? And there's something to it. Even though we can laugh about it, we think it's ridiculous, but there's something to it which is actually point this, that in some way that it's persuasive in a sense. It's something which obviously a lot of people have said, yeah, this sounds like something which is going to get me advanced in my spiritual practice. There's some reason for it. I mean, typically what they'll say is something like that, in the Indian sphere anyway, they'll say that by doing that you burn off your past karma. Okay, so this is the Jaina view, is that by tormenting yourself and giving rise to these terrible, painful feelings, that you're burning off your past karma. Yeah? And so, you know, if you think about the psychology of that, well, there's a kind of a guilt pattern involved there, isn't there? You know, there's a kind of feeling like, well, I'm a bad person somehow, therefore I've got to hurt, I deserve to suffer. And the more that I suffer, the more that I prove that somehow, you know, I can be good because I've experienced so much pain. And there's this kind of twisted psychology, at the motivation at the base of that. And we have this idea of from the traditional Buddhist point of view, we have this idea of the Bodhisattva as having sort of developed his wisdom and his baramis and so on for so many thousands of eons, yeah, up until this final life. And yet how could he take such a wrong turn? Yeah, he's developed his spiritual perfections and his wisdom and so on for thousands of past lives, thousands of eons. And that right at the last moment, completely loses the plot and goes off and does something completely silly. Yeah, this is a big problem for the traditional Theravadan, or the traditional Buddhist approach, not just Theravadan, but every Buddhist tradition. And you'll always find that when you look at how this story is told and how it's discussed within the traditions, that there'll always be some kind of way of rationalizing this. And I talked a bit about this last time when I mentioned that moment when the Buddha left his family behind, yeah? And so you have this emotional problem where, you know, the Buddha abandoned his wife and child, right? Or the Buddha to be abandoned his wife and child, and so it's very problematic, yeah? And so it stirs up emotions, and it demands to be addressed, and so it's through these issues, these points of tension within the story, that this is what that invites, that inquiry invites investigation. So when you look at the different tellings, the storytellers will always tell it to explain it in one way, a different way or another. And this time of the Buddha's doing his self-mortification practice is also explained in very different ways in almost every different tradition, and every different teller, who different commentator who comments on it has a different rationalization for it. So some will say that he did that practice because he had committed some bad karma in his past life and he had to work off this bad karma. Or some will say that he did it because he had to prove his unconquerable energy, develop his unconquerable energy. Or they'll say that he did it in order to set an example for people on how resolute one should be in the practice. Or he did it to prove that he wasn't any wimpier than the other ascetics who were around at the time. Yeah, so there are all these different kinds of explanations which are given, but actually in the suttas, when the Buddha explains it, he actually gives an explanation. Right, so all of these later explanations which were developed, but actually the Buddha himself said explicitly in the Bodhi Sutta, Bodhi Rajakumara Sutta, I did that because I believed that the way to pleasure was not through pleasure, but the way to pleasure was through pain. This is what he said. I believe that I can reach pleasure by subjecting myself to pain. I had this belief, and that's why I did those practices. Yeah? And of course, this being the fundamental tenet of the Jaina religion, through pain that you arrive at pleasure. So then you realize this is a big mistake. Yeah, how do you get to pleasure through pain? I kept on torturing myself. I'm waiting. I'm waiting for that pleasure to kick in sometime, but it's taking its time. 5 years later, 6 years later. No, it's not going to work. It's never going to work, and you can keep on doing that. Why? Because as the Buddha said when he spoke to some Jains, and they said, what are we doing? They said, we're burning off our past karma. And the Buddha said, but do you feel these painful feelings, and that burns off your past karma? And they said, yeah. And he said, but do you feel those painful feelings when you're doing these self-torment practices? They said, yes. And do you not feel them when you're not doing the practices? They said, that's right. And he said, well, isn't it the case that the painful feelings are caused by these practices that you're doing? Yeah? They're not caused by your past karma. They're caused by what you're doing here and now. And they were a bit kind of stumped by that one. And they said, well, this is our practice, this is our teaching, this is what we're doing, so get out of here. So it's what we're doing now which is matters. It's what the Buddha always pointed to. Our practice is what we're doing now. How do we understand our mind now? How do we overcome the defilements in our mind now? And it's not about overcoming karma from a past life. There's always more karma from past lives. If you really believe in rebirth, yeah? If you really believe in rebirth, and you think about how many times we've been reborn, yeah? Countless times, infinite times. It doesn't stop. There's no beginning to samsara. Every lifetime we're born in samsara, we're making karma, we're making choices, yeah? How are we going to ever make an end of it? There's no ending of it like that. So the way of practicing Buddhism is not through making an ending of this infinite store of karma, but it's through understanding. So the Buddha left all of those things. And then he thought back and he remembered, he said, what about that time? And you can imagine again, just sort of put yourself in his state of mind, if you can, at that time. You know, he's left everything. He's left his family, yeah? Left his kingdom, everything. He's gone to live in the forest, studied with these great teachers, reached these profound meditation states, gone through this whole self-torment. And in all of that, you notice how all of that is, in a sense, quite culturally determined. Yeah? He's done that because he was in India at that time and that place, and that's what other people were doing. Yeah? Yeah? They're doing it, therefore I'll do it. So this is actually very basic to human behavior, isn't it? I mean, that's how we do stuff. We do stuff because we see other people doing it. Yeah? We imitate. And we think somehow they've got it right. Yeah? There's always that cast bumper sticker that you see, I'm lost too. Yeah? Yeah? But that's how we are in samsara, isn't it? Yeah, we should all walk around with signs like that. So I'm lost too. Yeah? Don't follow me. Why are we following each other? So that's what he was doing. He was following other people who were just as lost as he was. So again, this very, you know, think of this profound dedication that he had to pursue these ways of practice for so many years, not really knowing what the outcome would be. And you know, it must have been quite difficult, yeah? He's really thrown on his own resources. He's tried everything, yeah? He's followed everybody's example, followed all the teachings. He's done it absolutely 100%. There's no question, I didn't do it properly. He's done it 100%, and yet he still hasn't got anywhere. Yeah? And so then he reaches that moment. And what is the crux of that moment? The crux of that moment is that he has to fall back on himself. He falls back on his own experience and his own insight, and he's not being led by the insights of another. Yeah? Very, very important. That's that crux. And he remembers, that time. What was that time when I was at the when I was a child, and I was sitting under the cool shade of the rose apple tree. And there was that time, and my mind went into this state of samadhi. And at that time, he went into the first jhana when he was a boy. Just very naturally, just peacefully sitting there under the shade. Ah, and then he thought, maybe that could be the way to enlightenment. And then the sutta says that then that the awareness, the vijnana, arose in him, esova mago bodhaya, that indeed is the path to enlightenment, to awakening. Yeah? So he could remember that very blissful experience of first jhana that he had when he was a child. Ah, mind is so peaceful, so blissful. And it's not based on imitating anybody. It's not based on following somebody, doing what somebody else did. It's not based on an idea of what spiritual practice should be. Because he's just a kid. And he just sits down and his mind goes peaceful. And for me, this is one of the most realistic details in the whole of the Buddha's life story. Even though it might seem, extraordinary that a child can get into a state of jhana. We can go away and do all kinds of meditation retreats and things and still can't get into jhanas. And he's just a kid. And he gets into it. So actually, I think it's quite common, to be honest. And I think that it would be interesting to do some study of that. I don't know if anything's been done, but I actually think that a fair number of people probably do spontaneously get into some kind of meditation state, jhana state, samadhi state, while not doing anything, while not doing any meditation. But the problem with that was that when he was a kid, he didn't know what to do with it. Yeah? You just sit there, mind gets peaceful, what do I do? There's no framework, there's no way of understanding it. So he just gets back up and goes and plays or does whatever he does. You know, he goes and messes around, puts around or something. So as you compare those two experiences, like when he had that experience with his two teachers, Alara Kalama and Uddhakarama Putta, where he was within that framework. So they started out telling him his teaching, yeah, probably teaching him some kind of soul theory or something like that, you know, your Atman and all of these things. Then he did the practice, and the practice was in a sense confirming this. So, you know, usually in these kinds of teachings, it'll say, you know, you practice and you realize, and that light that you see is your soul, is yourself, that's your eternal essence, or else they'll say that's God, or that's Krishna, or that's Jesus, or whoever it is. And so they're giving you a program that's telling you how to interpret and understand your meditation experience. Yeah? And so this is why that package the Buddha simply couldn't accept. But when he was a kid and he sat down under the rose apple tree, and there wasn't any program, there wasn't any theory, he realized, oh, actually, it's not about some kind of theory about the self or the soul or eternity or God or the universe or anything like that, but it's just the nature of the mind to become peaceful. And when there's nothing to disturb the mind, the mind's own nature will just become peaceful, and it becomes so happy to be sitting quietly and still within itself. Esova mago bodhaya, that indeed is the path to awakening. And so it's this realization of pleasure, the pleasure that comes from meditation, and that was the crucial point that led to his breakthrough, that led to his enlightenment. Not the pain that he suffered, through the self-torment and so on. He said that was useless. It was a complete waste of time. I didn't learn anything from that. But it's the pleasure he experienced in the mind. That's what led to his enlightenment. So he said, okay, I want to try and practice that again, but I can't do that because my body's too weak. I haven't been eating properly, my health is no good, and so on. So then he went and ate the milk rice. And so this got a very famous episode and told in a lot of detail in the later stories, where Sujata, the local village girl, comes and offers the milk rice to the Buddha. And that's that particular episode, a favorite episode in the Buddha's biographies. It's one of these things that's in the actual original sutta, it just says, oh, I ate some porridge and bread. I ate some bread and rice, that's it. doesn't say anything about Sujata and the milk rice and all of these things. It's just very brief. But in later tradition, there's all kinds of stories about Sujata. That she's got different names in different versions, and sometimes it's one, sometimes it's three. She comes and offers the food. And the milk rice she fed, she got the milk of 500 cows, and then she fed that milk from 500 cows to 50 cows, and they ate that, and then they got the milk from the 50 cows, they fed it to 5 cows, and then they got that, and they fed it to 1 cow, and then they got the milk from that, and that's what they made the milk rice from. Yeah? Yeah? That's one version. And there's other versions as well. There's one of the versions in the Tibetan tradition where Sujata was immediately fell completely in love with the Buddha when he went for alms through the village. Yeah? So there's this whole kind of romantic, interesting, and she's chasing him out of the village and everything, and it's a whole convoluted story. But eventually, the basic idea is that it's the nourishment that she gave, yeah, which was what enabled him to gain the health and gain the strength and gain the life to be able to practice. Very, very important crux in that story, because the practices he was doing before were life negating. Yeah, he was destroying his body. He was destroying his life. Yeah, and so this is that kind of ascetic tendency that sees the world of the flesh as being somehow wrong and bad, and wants to deny the flesh and to turn away from it and to push it away. Yeah? This is that ascetic tendency. But this is that moment when he realized that actually this is where we're living. This is, my life is dependent on this. My spiritual practice is not about denying and destroying my flesh, but about understanding it, about nurturing it, about being part of it. And so accepting this from Sujata, it's very, very important, because it marks that moment where he moves towards that. There's a kind of a gentleness to that. There's a sense of care. There's a sense of nourishment. All of these very gentle qualities are coming back into his practice, which were absent beforehand. And so, of course, this is where the group of five ascetics then reject him. They say he's gone soft, right? So that's that tough ascetic mind. Yeah? And you can see that still in contemporary Buddhism. Yeah. And a kind of really sort of gung-ho kind of attitude. And, you know, I've seen that in the monks and in the forest tradition. This is what they do sometimes. And they'll do these kinds of really ascetic practices to, you know, like only eating, you know, 5 lumps of sticky rice a day for the 3 months of the range retreat, you know. One monk did that one time, but when I was saying it, Lanachan sort of had to get taken off to hospital at the end of it. Next year he relented and had a pinch of salt with his rice. And so people do these kinds of things, huh? But there's a kind of acceptance. Well, yes, of course our body does get sick. Of course our body does rot. It does get old. All of those things. It's all true, yeah? And of course if we just want to find happiness, you know, through being young and beautiful and healthy and all of those things, well, yeah, you can find a bit of happiness for that, and a few years later you're not going to be young and beautiful and healthy and everything, and you're going to get old, bits are going to fall off, and then you're going to die, right? So that's the reality of it. That's the ascetic reality. But meanwhile we're here, so we take care of the body, yeah? So we understand it. So then he took the milk rice, he went off, he meditated. Now, there's a number of different texts that talk about the practice that he did there and go into some detail about the different kinds. It's not sure, actually. If you read the mainstream account, it sounds like he sort of ate the milk rice and then went off and meditated and got enlightened more or less straight away. But there's also quite a number of suttas, especially in the Madhyama Nikaya, that seem to talk about this period of practice and seem to talk about it actually extending over quite a period of time and the different ways that the practice was developed. One very important one is in the sutta called the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta, the Majjhima Nikaya. The Dvaita Vitaka means the two kinds of thoughts. And so this two kinds of thoughts sutta, essentially the Buddha says, okay, you know, here I am sitting here trying to meditate, and I'm thinking all the time, right? Very important, right? But he sat there, and he was trying to meditate. What's he doing? He's sitting there thinking about things, all right? That's a relief, isn't it? Huh? He's not... When the Buddha was describing his own practice, he wasn't saying, you know, here I am, such a great practitioner, I was so advanced, I had all of these wonderful things and all of these great things were happening to me and wasn't it marvelous? No, that's not what you find. What he says is, he listens to what the monks are talking about and they say, we're having these problems, and the Buddha says, oh yeah, I had exactly the same kind of problem when I was practicing. Yeah? And this is exactly what you find in the Buddha's own accounts of his practice. He's not setting himself differently. He's saying, yeah, that's how it is, that's what I have. So this time he's sitting there and so he thinks, okay, what about, I can recognize that some of these thoughts that I'm thinking are harmful, yeah, negative thoughts, yeah, thoughts of greed, hatred and delusion. Well, what? And then other thoughts are not harmful. Yeah, I can see that they're thoughts of kindness and thoughts of giving up. So how about if I be mindful, be aware of these two kinds of thoughts and then learn to abandon the harmful thoughts and just develop the good thoughts. Yeah. So there's a lovely story about this, about there's a monk in later years called Upagupta. He's in the time of King Ashoka, and Upagupta was a merchant's son. And, is this Upagupta or his teacher, Shanakavasin? I can't remember now, I think it was Upagupta. And he was a merchant's son, and he wanted to practice, but he was having to work in a shop. And so he didn't know how to practice, you know, because he was having to work all day. And so his teacher said to him, okay, I want you to get two bowls, one with black rock and one with white stones, white black pebbles and white pebbles, okay? And every time you have a bad thought, you take one of the black pebbles and put it in a pile. And every time you have a good thought, you take one of the white pebbles and put it into a pile. Yeah? And then you can do that while you're serving the customers and you're working in the shop. And then you can see how you're going at the end of each day. Yeah? So the first day he does it, he's got a big pile of black pebbles, a couple of white ones in there. And he thinks, oh, crikey, that's not so good, is it? So never mind. He keeps on going. So it's just about awareness. It's not about, you know, forcing himself to only think the good thoughts, but this is makes it vivid. Next day he does it, there's a few more white pebbles in it, and then each day he does that practice, there's more white pebbles, until eventually the pile of pebbles is only white pebbles, you know? And that's only through like reflection and awareness, you know? This is the best way of training your mind. So this is what the Buddha did. So he thinks, okay, gets to that stage where he's only thinking the positive thoughts, the good thoughts, and then he thinks, but even just thinking only these good thoughts, fine, I'm not doing any harm to anybody, I can keep thinking these good thoughts from one day to the next constantly, and I'll never cause any harm to myself or any harm to others, but I still can't make my mind very peaceful, yeah? Because even these good thoughts, even these wholesome thoughts are still some kind of activity or agitation in my mind. So I wonder if I can abandon even these very good thoughts and then bring my mind to a state of peace and state of stillness. So this was the next stage of practice that he did. And there's one sutta where it talks about the way that thoughts are abandoned. It's a very interesting one. It says that first of all, you know, you can abandon like unwholesome thoughts, the thoughts of greed, hatred and delusion. Okay, so this is, hopefully if you can get to that stage, then you're doing pretty well. But then you've still got those ones. But then next one you have left is thoughts of your family, yeah, or thoughts of your reputation is another one it says, and also thoughts of your country. Okay, so thoughts of what's happening in society around you and people around you and so on. So even though these thoughts are not unwholesome as such, but there's still some kind of disturbance in your mind. So then you can abandon even those ones, and what's left is thoughts about the Dhamma, yeah, Dhamma Vitaka, yeah. So that's pretty good, yeah? So, you know, your mind is purified to the extent that you're thinking about Dhamma and mind is inclining in that way. But still, your mind can't become very peaceful. So abandon even the thoughts about Dhamma have to be abandoned, yeah? And then the mind can go into Samadhi, yeah? Only when you abandon the thoughts about Dhamma. Alright, so it's not to say thinking about Dhamma is bad. You remember that, you know, the Buddha said, that you can keep on thinking those thoughts, that's fine. And that's a very good example, I think, that example with Upagupta and the pebbles in his store, because you have to remember that you know, when we're doing things in our ordinary activities, the mind thinks. Yeah, we can't not think when we're doing things. And sometimes meditators seem to think that, you know, practice of Dhamma and Buddhism means, you know, you have to just be, you know, not think. But no, you think, but you just learn to think in a beneficial way. And then, when it comes time to meditate, then we learn to abandon that thinking and to go into samadhi and to develop that. But again, even that development of samadhi for the Buddha was not unproblematic. And when he was discussing this with the monks, and they said, we develop our samadhi to a certain extent, you know, we get this very brilliant light coming in our mind, like this nimitta, but then something happens and it goes, and we don't know why. And the Buddha says, you have to investigate at that point, yeah? You have to inquire. It's in the Upakilesa Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya. You have to inquire, what's the reason for that? What's the cause why this light will sometimes come in the mind and sometimes won't? Same thing happened to me, is what he said. Same thing happened to me. And then I saw, when that light was there, and then somehow this doubt came into my mind. Yeah, I could see there's this doubting, and then I realized it's because of the doubt that the light disappeared. Or else a restlessness came into my mind, and because of the restlessness, the light disappeared. Or I thought, maybe I'm pushing too hard. Yeah, pushing too much. And then because of pushing too much, then the light disappeared. Yeah. Or maybe I'm being a bit lazy, I'm not pushing hard enough, yeah? And then, same way, the light disappears. And so all these different kind of reasons, this very subtle stage of meditation, and still, you know, for the Buddha, the long period of training and practicing to be able to train his mind, to be able to develop those peaceful states of mind. Finally, of course, he did realize that. And develop those and ultimately to realize enlightenment. So I was meaning to talk about the practice of Buddha before his enlightenment, the enlightenment experience, and then what happened afterwards. That was my thought for tonight, but I've only done the first part of that, and that's probably enough time already. So anyway, maybe another time we can talk more about the other stages then. So that's probably enough for this evening, and I'd like to invite any comments or questions before we finish up. Yeah.
I always wonder about detachment and being socially engaged. For example, I spent time in Theravada Monastery and I know that it can be a very nice, like, monastic, because you're living in seclusion and you can develop a nice samadhi and you become a bit detached, and then people come and tell you their problems and it's like they're speaking from far away and you're kind of like, oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
How can I say this? Then there was a monk who got married to a woman, and she would tell him her problem, and he'd be like that, very equanimous, and he'd just say, let go, let go.
Mm-hmm.
And he wouldn't engage her, which was making her more frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you find a balance between compassionate empathizing, but not being sucked in?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I noticed the bhikshus, like with the bhikshuni ordination, you know, often it wasn't always that they were women haters, or they were just kind of very much in their own practice and they weren't that interested in what was going on outside.
Yeah.
And there's this kind of apathy amongst Buddhists sometimes, which I find not so good sometimes.
Oh, look, absolutely, yeah. And I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about because I've lived it. You know, I've been there and in the forest monasteries, and I know what it feels like. You know, and you get very, you can be very, very peaceful. The world becomes very small because it's just, you know, you're just there, and it's just, you know, your little hut, and you know, it's very nice and it's very peaceful, and it's your little hut and this little group of people around you, and. As you said, there's this kind of sense of detachment from things. As to how to, and I think that that's problematic in a sense, and I think that if I think this is I think that's something which is only really beneficial, like at a certain stage, or at a certain stage of spiritual development, or as a complementary part of spiritual development. But if it's pursued as being the be-all and end-all, especially too soon or for the wrong person, then I think it can be quite dangerous in itself. And I would agree completely that very often this kind of Dhamma language is used as a way of escaping, you know, just let go and so on. It's basically used as a sense of denial of things, avoidance of them. And we have to learn the difference between something which needs to be investigated and understood and something which needs to be just to let go of. And if you look in the suttas in the Vinaya, that the Buddha didn't just say to everybody who came to him with problems, let go of it, you know? And the Buddha responded in different ways to different people at different times, yeah? And when, for example, one obvious example is the Kalamas. The Kalamas came to him and said, look, we have all these different teachers. They're all teaching us different things. What do we do about it? So the Buddha didn't say, let go, stop worrying. He said, you're doubting about a doubtful matter. Yeah? So he's actually showing that he's listening to them and responding to the actual problem that they've had. So, I don't have the answer to that question at all. But the only thing I would say as a pragmatic guideline, okay, that I use is if somebody talks to me about problems and so on, and it may be just my own character, but my basic character is that I will listen to and address that problem first of all. Now, that's not necessarily the right thing to do, because often it's better to actually address the person rather than the problem which the person is presenting. Yeah? But what I do is I try to listen to what's the problem. Yeah? And I trust that the person has presented the problem, you know, that it's meaningful, it's relevant. Yeah? But if that doesn't work, then you maybe think, well, where's that person coming from? You know, if you sort of can solve that problem, but then more problems keep on coming up, then it's a sign that actually that's not the issue, that something else is the issue. So the way I tend to approach it is basically on a fairly literal level. That, you know, if someone presents an issue, you deal with that issue. Overcoming apathy. Oh, get into the real world. I think they send them along to India to go and work with you in India with the poor people for a while. Yeah. I mean, I think the way the Buddha would describe his practice, like when he was asked what's the difference between you and other practitioners, he said, well, I was the first one on the path. I was the discoverer of the path, and then other people followed along behind me. Yeah. So, as what I emphasised in that story, that actually it was that very fact of the Buddha coming to reliance on himself was a critical part of that. And I think that's something, even when we follow the Buddha's path, that's still the case. And that's actually one of the really difficult things, is because for us, we're actually following somebody else's teachings, yeah? But there comes a point when we shouldn't be following somebody else's teachings, yeah? We need to realise it for ourselves. And so it's very interesting that one of the words for the stream enterer on the first stage of enlightenment, it says aparapachaya, is not dependent on another. Yeah? So to reach that stage, to reach even the first stage of enlightenment, aparapachaya, not dependent on another. And somebody asked Sariputta once about that, and he said, you know, do you have faith in the Buddha's enlightenment? He said, no, I don't have any faith. Yeah. And he said, well, he's even the Buddha's greatest disciple says he doesn't have any faith. He said, why should I have faith? I know it and see it for myself. Yeah. So why should I have any, why what's the need for faith? So, but you know, that thing, if you think of the Buddha as like the explorer, like Buddha in Australia, you have like Burke and Wills and so on, who sort of explored the country and sort of went across the road. Well, yeah, they wandered into deserts and wildernesses and across marshes and so on, but they didn't make it in the end. They died in the desert. But anyway, let's assume that they made it. But we don't have to. So we can still follow, and there's still challenges along the way, and we still experience more than enough pain to teach us what we need to know, I think, you know, without actually going out and searching for it, right? But that's one of the things that we've learnt, you know, that's how they learnt the terrain, by just wandering at random and then finding their way. But thankfully we don't have to do that. Yep?
Mahamalukya Sutra, in there that the Buddha describes that gathering the four jhanas in the first three formless attainments. Mm-hmm. Use that as a basis for, you know, reflecting on using anicca, dukkha, anatta. Mm-hmm. Why not the fourth?
Oh, that's a very subtle question, that one. It's a very interesting little point. And the standard explanation for that is that the fourth formless attainment, neva sanya na sanya, neither perception nor non-perception, is so subtle that you can't really develop insight on that basis. It's even too subtle. So that the realm of nothingness is one that's often emphasized as being good for developing insight. Yeah.
And is it Alara Kalama part of the, you know, from the Kalama Sutra?
I presume so. Yeah. We know very little about them, and but from the name, I would guess it's probably from the same clan. Yeah. I mean, I'm not aware of that. It'd be interesting to look at the sociology of that, whether it's sort of from one particular region. It sounds like the Kalama Sutra, he was in the Kalama country, so they're probably from one region, and I guess probably that's where Alara Kalama came from. Yeah.
Nothingness versus emptiness.
Nothingness versus emptiness. Completely different. In nothing is nothing, and in emptiness is empty. I mean, it's chalk and cheese.